The beef on dairy was another way to add value back to those male bull calves that were coming from dairy farms. If we look back to that time, around 2014, I guess, we were coming to a lull in the cattle cycle, much like we are now. But Jersey bull calves were essentially worth nothing. Some people would say negative money.
Right.
That was really a problem, a welfare problem as well, that we wanted to address and see if we could bring some value to those cattle. Jersey cattle are known to marble quite well as Holsteins, just those two dairy breeds in general. So there was some potential there that we could create a niche market type product, a high quality product that could maybe demand some premium.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Virbac, committed to growth. For information, visit vet-us.virbac.com/cattle or see your Virbac representative. Be proactive with Cattle Active. Visit proearthanimalhealth.com today. Healthy Farms by Bioverse, your manure management experts. Contact us for time and labor saving solutions. Data shows most cattle don't get enough vitamin D, which can impact health and performance. High D from DSM Firmenich can help improve cattle's vitamin D status.
Today we've got Jared Jaborg, Dr. Jared Jaborg from Michigan State. Jared, thanks for jumping on and talking to us today. I think this is a really interesting and a hot topic for the industry on both the beef and the dairy side, is the beef on dairy. But before we get into, you know, beef on dairy and a lot of the research that you did and are doing, kind of give us a background of how you got where you are now, and why did you go this route of wanting to focus on beef on dairy?
Well, first off, thanks for having me here. It's always nice to chime in and participate in some of these podcasts. So I grew up in agriculture, grew up with cattle, so always had a passion for that. Got into grad school, realized I didn't want to cut meat for the rest of my life right out of college. So went off to grad school because I really enjoyed learning new things. And my project was supposed to be beef on dairy with Jersey crossbreeding. Huh. It got delayed about a year, so it ended up being more for my PhD than my master's. But regardless, that's how I got started in the beef on dairy space. And little did everyone know probably back then. I mean, this was back in, this project was supposed to start, I think, in 2014, maybe 2013, something like that. So, I mean, yeah. You know, these things take time to plan, but right. This was a little bit of ahead of its time if we think about how popular beef on dairy has become nowadays.
So what you know, growing up, did you grow up on a farm or a ranch that this is, you know, kind of your passion and wanted to get into, or is this something that you just kind of, one of those things that doors just opened, you had an interest in, and here you are?
Yeah, so my grandparents had a dairy farm, stanchion barn, that held maybe about 50 cows or so.
Yeah.
So grew up around cattle, loved it. My folks also had a beef farm, so we had cow-calf operation, smaller, I'd say, probably ranged from anywhere 20 to 30 cows. We had Simmental cattle, so I was around cattle all the time, knew I wanted to do something with them. I think a lot of people think they want to go off to be a veterinarian. I thought it was cool seeing all the surgeries and all that stuff. But I think it was my senior year of my undergrad, I realized that, you know what, maybe that's not for me. I mean, I had done pre-vet and I had done all the prerequisites, put in all the work for it, and that wasn't really the problem. But then I just got to thinking, man, that's a lot of hours, a lot of student debt. And so just decided to look for different opportunities. And I thankfully had a great network around me. I've been able to meet the right people at the right time that have led me down this trail to go pursue my master's and stick around for a PhD. And so that's kind of led me to where I am now.
So I guess tell the audience, what do you do now? What's your job and what's your focus?
So currently I work with Michigan State University Extension. Extension's they have a few different institutes. I'm in the agricultural institute. So I actually hold the title of beef feedlot systems educator. It's a statewide responsibilities covering anything feedlot related. I'm one of the members of the MSU beef team. So we have a few individuals that are focused on beef cattle. We have a few people that do more of the grazing side. And then I guess I would do more of the cattle feeding side or confined cattle feeding side. So that's kind of what my general role, I guess, is with MSU Extension.
So let's get back to the topic of beef on dairy and, talk about what you have found and, a lot of the research you've been doing with the impact of, crossing beef on dairy cows.
Yeah, so I guess I'm going to start from the beginning from grad school working with the Jerseys. Basically, the beef on dairy was another way to add value back to those male bull calves that were coming from dairy farms. If we look back to that time, around 2014, I guess, we were coming to a lull in the cattle cycle, much like we are now. But Jersey bull calves were essentially worth nothing. Some people would say negative money.
Right.
That was really a problem, a welfare problem as well, that we wanted to address and see if we could bring some value to those cattle. Jersey cattle are known to marble quite well as Holsteins, just those two dairy breeds in general. So there was some potential there that we could create a niche market type product, a high quality product that could maybe demand some premium. So we raised some cattle. We crossed them with Angus, Sim Angus, and some Red Wagyu bulls. Brought in those calves to our feedlot and fed them out and basically measured how they would stand up against each other in the feedlot and then did some meat quality testing as well. Basically, what we found is that those crossbreds outperformed the purebreds, maybe not entirely surprising. And then from a quality standpoint, all the crossbreds actually marbled better than the purebred jerseys alone. Mm-hmm. So there was really great quality. I think the jerseys themselves averaged an average choice grade. So it just goes to show how good the other ones were. They were all high choice, or I think the Angus treatment actually averaged low prime. So really high quality product. We measured tenderness too. I think the Sim Angus sired and Red Wagyu sired cattle had some really good. I mean, they were all really good. If you look at USDA standards for what's right. very tender, all these cattle, I mean, the extremely tender product. So we created really good product. This is an all natural product. We didn't use implants or anything like that. Looking back, these type of cattle probably require some of those technologies that we have available nowadays. We didn't investigate them in our situation, but looking at the yield data, so we actually did a full cutout on these carcasses as well to see what they actually looked like. And one of our major findings was that the USDA yield grade equation does not estimate or predict the cutability of these cattle, even remotely close. There's huge discrepancies. And these cattle they don't have the muscle mass first. And then they also just carry a lot more fat on them, a lot of internal fat, which doesn't offer a lot of value to those cattle either. So those are a few of the challenges of working with those types of cattle as well, but they do create a really high quality product. And that is a great opportunity for those type of cattle. So that's in the Jersey setting. Obviously, we have more Holstein cows out there in the dairy industry. So once I came to Michigan State, I mean, the beef on dairy was starting to gain some popularity. Right in the middle of COVID, I suppose. So it was starting to gain some popularity. People weren't exactly sure what they were doing. They were just trying to produce a black calf and capture that premium for hopefully a CAB product. Obviously, we've come much further to hopefully teach our dairy producers that, you need to be intentional on the decisions, what type of bulls you're using to make sure you're getting the proper traits so that those calves can perform in the feedlot and they actually produce a high quality product that we can put on your plate. So we've been working on that. A lot of my extension roles have went around trying to educate those facts. We completed our first study a couple of years ago. Now the paper just came out here in earlier this year. But we crossed, well, we had the beef Holstein crosses compared to Holsteins. And just a corn silage-based diet that's pretty common here in Michigan. Some distillers for protein, and then the rest basically high moisture corn. And basically the findings that we found from that study is that crossbreeding increased the improved performance. We saw a little bit greater rate of gain. No difference in feed intake. I know some people have said maybe the Holsteins did a little bit more, but we did not see that. And because we had a little bit better gain, we did see better or improved feed efficiency from those crossbreds compared to the straight bred Holsteins. So our goal there, looking for a harvest endpoint, was because when you're comparing beef and you're comparing Holsteins, the breeds are so different. They deposit fat differently. Mm-hmm. It's not really fair. A lot of our common endpoints, you can't compare them at a similar days on feed because composition is going to be so different.
Yep.
Can't compare them at a similar fat thickness because then you're not finishing basically the beef cattle, and because the dairy cattle don't put on as much back fat. So you got all these differences. So basically we decided we'd harvest them at a similar estimated empty body fat, if you will, using some equations that have been developed. Did some ultrasound scanning of those cattle. We're able to predict that. Of course, the equation it over predicted what they actually had. So our marbling scores weren't quite as great as we were hoping for. Probably should have had the cattle on feed for about another month. But basically our Holsteins required, I think it was 3 weeks longer on feed. So their inputs drove up their costs a little bit. But on the carcass side, the crosses, they had more back fat, but they had significantly greater ribeye area. So they started to carry, you could visually see it. They just held a lot more muscle on those carcasses as well. Yeah. So it'll be interesting. Actually, we haven't done it yet, but it's one of our intents with some of our future research is to actually do a cutout on those cattle and see how they compare. I think there has been some work recently. I just seen out of Texas, one of the universities down there, that has shown that, the cross cattle, just they carry more muscle as well,
yeah,
particularly in the round. And we saw that with the Jersey data as well. The crossbreds where they carried a little bit more weight was in the round or in the chuck, particularly not so much in the middle meats like the loin, but typically in those bigger muscles in the hind quarter or the fore quarter.
So one of the negatives I always hear is you know, you do see an increase in quality of the crossbreds, but you still see this very triangular lack of shape muscle. And you can easily pick out even the black hided ones, you know, they're Holstein crosses just by their shape. So you still see or hear that they're getting discounted just from the shape of the muscle, even though there's an increase in quality over what that Holstein would have been. Are you still seeing that trend of the shape of the muscle was still not where it, you know, what you would see a traditional beef carcass would be? And so those carcasses may be getting discounted.
We were still seeing that a little bit in that study that we did. Granted, now it's been a couple of years since those cattle were harvested. But that's part of the problem right now with the beef on dairy. And as we continue to educate, hopefully we'll get away from that. But
yeah,
part of that is just the variability in the bulls that are getting used, the sires. A lot of people are concerned, what breed do I need to use? What, you know, do I need Angus? Do I need Simmental? You know, what is it? The breed really doesn't matter. It comes down to picking a good bull. Does it compare well across breeds? That's probably the most important thing. And USDA, Meat Animal Research Center, actually puts out EPD adjustments. So you can compare how bulls actually stack up against each other across breeds, which I always think is a really neat tool. But it comes down to how, what is that sire actually like? And right now, I mean, these calf prices for newborn crossbred calves is just outrageous. Frankly, I'm not sure how people are able to afford buying them from the feeder standpoint. And then those feeders are, they're selling high as well to make up the money for that calf. And then the feedlot takes on that. So I don't know how they're recouping that money on the back end, because there is a lot of, if you talk with some of the packers that, particularly like JBS, who takes a lot of these cattle here in Michigan, it's the variability. So that's one of the weaknesses, I guess, or threats the packer would, you know, that's what they don't want. They want to create a uniform product that they can sell to their customer. And so that's the biggest downfall right now. So if we can start creating or do a better job at creating a more uniform product. And now not all those crossbred cattle have that angular shaped ribeye. It's a few. And that's the problem, is you got a few that look more Holstein like, and then you got some that are in between, and you got some that are just as good as the beef cattle. So we just need to shift that bell shaped curve towards the beef side, so we can improve uniformity across the board on those cattle. And it's a work in progress. I think we are making some progress. There's a lot of our industry stakeholders from our stud companies out there that are, they have programs, they have bull lineups that are selected for beef on dairy. So there is some intentionality going into those decisions, which is always great to see.
So working with dairy producers, do you have a recommendation of what they should be looking for in EPDs, you know, of those bulls that they should be using for that sex semen?
Touch on two things on that. You mentioned sex semen. There's not a lot of options as far as beef bulls for sex semen. There's some out there, but maybe they don't have the best EPDs that we're looking for.
Right.
What I always like to preach, I guess, or try to educate producers is look for calving ease. Obviously, that's the most important thing for these dairy producers, is they need to have a live calf. They don't want to compromise the cow, because ultimately that's how they make their money, is through milk production. So make sure you have good calving ease so you don't have any problems there. Growth is the next thing. Obviously, pounds, that's how we get paid. Calves that are growing faster, quicker, more efficiently, that's where you can add value. So looking at your weaning weight and your yearly weight, EPDs are two factors of growth. The other two things come down on the quality or the carcass side, and that's looking at ribeye area, because it's an indicator of muscling ability. We need to add muscle to these cattle, where we're crossing them with a dairy breed that is finely muscled. We need to add as much muscle as possible to increase yield from those carcasses. So ribeye area is a strong recommendation to look at that. And then obviously we're in a quality driven market, so looking at marbling as well. We don't want to sacrifice marbling. Holsteins are known to marble well, but obviously you don't want to compromise that from the beef side if we don't have to. So those are the traits that I usually try to produce or encourage producers to look at. We're actually doing a study at Michigan State where we selected some bulls based on those criteria in the top, I don't know, 25% of their breed. So basically proof of concept that, hey, if you select these bulls, if you select these sires that rank really well, ultimately you can have offspring that are going to perform above the average of, you know, other crossbred cattle. I mean, we're going to shift that. Maybe they'll be more like beef cattle than the average crossbred, or those that are more similar to the straight bred Holstein. So that's our intent there, kind of a proof of concept to show our producers, hey, this actually works.
So one comment I get from feedlots sometimes is that they're concerned about how these calves are managed from that point of leaving the dairy until they get to the feedlot. Some have seen increased sickness, and we can get into some, you know, liver issues, but abscesses issues, but there's been some comments of highly concerned about how these calves get managed. And they feel like sometimes they're setting up these calves very poorly for the feedlot.
Yeah.
Do you ever hear that? And is there any challenges of working with how these calves go from the dairy into a calf system and then into the feedlot?
The popularity of beef on dairy has definitely opened up the doors of who's raising these cattle. Now, we have to keep in mind these beef on dairy cattle, they're growing up in a dairy system. Mm. So if they weren't beef cross dairy, they were going to be dairy. Mm. So I think we have more people feeding cattle coming from these dairy systems just because they're black hided now. They wouldn't have fed them before as Holsteins. So you have differences there. Same probably goes with calf raising too. I think I wish there was more research out connecting early calfhood management. I mean, a lot of the research that is out there is done on bull calves. Maybe they're taken shortly after weaning and then they're not followed any longer to see how that early life treatment or affects their future performance in the feedlot. What are those lasting effects? Those would be really interesting data to see and interpret and obviously put to use nowadays. But I think that's where a lot of our problems are coming from is this early life management. Some people are doing it better than others. Some people I think are doing it and they maybe didn't do it before. So they're not familiar with it. They're running into issues. So it is very important. And some of those issues happen to be, if we're causing too many digestive upsets with those calves, if we're compromising their immune system and their health early on, if, you know, we're damaging those lungs and the liver, those calves are going to be compromised for the rest of their life. And they're not going to perform to the expectation that we have for them once they reach the feedlot.
Yeah. So how are we handling, because, you know, this is a very new area for a lot of people. It's a big increase in a number of calves coming in that are handled differently now. How are we working with producers of, you know, is it dairy producers mainly doing this, or are they still selling? I know here in Oregon, most of them are still selling those calves and they don't care how they're handled, what's the genetics. They just want to sell a beef calf. And so there's these issues that we need to overcome as, you know, as scientists, universities, of how do we handle that? But, you know, who's filling that void of managing these calves, and how's that going to change in the future as this takes on a new role of a standard practice versus this is a very hot area right now?
I think with where we are in the cattle cycle, you can see that there's obviously a great demand for calves, cattle, just because there's not a lot out there. So prices are high because of that. It's tough to have a negative feedback where, you know, you're not getting a quality calf, so I don't want to buy it. Right now, guys are like, I need anything I can get to fill up their yards. So obviously that's a bit of an issue there. But regarding what we can do, I think it, and this isn't so much an issue anymore today, but it always bears repeating, is on the dairy, those calves need colostrum just like any other calf. If you don't give that calf colostrum, you're going to compromise it. Make sure it's getting enough. So make sure the quantity is right. And then it's also high quality as well. You know, if you give them the right amount, but it's not high quality, that doesn't get the job done either. So colostrum is the first step. Second step is obviously once those, because those calves are probably leaving within a few days, within a week from most dairies being and going to some kind of calf raiser. And obviously working with their vet to figure out what kind of health protocol, what kind of vaccines they need to give those calves, give them some kind of protection right away, maybe an intranasal, something like that, so we can get those calves off to a good start. Obviously, nutrition's always important. Make sure that they're getting adequate nutrition. And then I think, as we start to transition those calves, you know, we want to encourage dry feeds, and a high energy starter is most common, but, we can't forget about providing them with a little bit of roughage. They don't need a whole lot, but some of the research would indicate it could be as low as 1% of their diet on a dry matter basis, but they need something, right. To maintain that proper rumen health. So you got, you still have mixing going on and pH doesn't get too low where we burn out these calves and they're, you know, developing acidosis and then the subsequent liver abscess problems that we commonly associate with these cattle.
So, and that touches on my next point that I wanted to move into was the liver abscess issues. And it, do you feel like in, that it, that's due to how these calves were set up prior to coming into feedlot? Is maybe they got a little burnt, wasn't managed properly, came in the feedlot already kind of susceptible, and then you have this increase?
Just like anything, I'm going to say it depends. I think there's actually probably one of two routes which this is kind of happening. And one of them, like you said, is happening early on in these calves potentially. I think that's a great source where, or a great opportunity where these calves can get burnt out early on. I mean, these calves are, soon as, I mean, they're weaned, they're on a high energy diet for their life, basically. That's, I mean, 300 some plus days is a long time compared to our conventional beef cattle that aren't even weaned off the cow, pasture, hay, whatever it may be, until after 7 months, probably. Yep. So big differences there in terms of the amount of time where they could potentially be exposed to those digestive upsets at such an early age, and they just carry on through. The second opportunity is obviously at the feedlot as well. So it comes down to feeding them appropriately there as well. So those are the two main options, I think, of where these this problem can be happening. So it just comes down to where is that feeding management maybe not as finely tuned, or where right. those problems are popping up. I mean, where are the weaknesses in your feeding program? Where do you need to maybe add a little bit of extra forage back in to help buffer that rumen and maintain proper gut health?
Yeah.
Now, that's another thing too with the research. We're still trying to kind of figure out where these liver abscesses coming from. Is it coming from those upsets that are occurring in the rumen, ruminal acidosis, or is it maybe like a high acidosis in the small intestine, for instance? So there's some interesting research going on, and we actually have a group of crossbreds versus Holsteins in the feedlot right now that we're hoping to look at some of those current questions, looking at some different tissue samples to see what the morphology looks like and stuff of that nature. And there is a interesting study. This is the one we're doing is kind of based off of that they did out at Nebraska, just different corn silage levels. I mean, and it's as simple as that sometimes, but we get so focused on having the greatest average daily gain or the greatest efficiency that we can compromise those cattle in the long run. Yeah. So that maybe we do start to have efficiency does start to suffer. Actually, on the one paper that is published, the one study we did finish, unfortunately, we weren't able to collect. There was a mix up at the plant. We didn't collect the data on the Holsteins. We didn't get told when they were coming through. But on the crossbreds, I think we had about 40% with liver abscesses, but those that had the severe abscesses versus more of the minor or didn't have the abscesses at all, there was, I want to say it was about 0.2 pounds of gain difference between those cattle.
But they gained more.
The severe ones gained less.
Gained less.
Yep. Those cattle with healthier livers gained a little bit better. So producers always say, well, liver abscess isn't an issue for me. I mean, I sell that's the packer's issue. Well, the reality is that affects overall animal health, and that is going to affect performance of those animals too.
Yep.
I mean, a lot of these guys are selling lots of cattle and it's just the lot that they're seeing, but you have individuals in there, and whatever percentage it is, like in our case, we had about 40% that had some kind of problem. And I can't remember which, how many of them were severe now, but those ones obviously had a reduced performance compared to their counterparts that were a little healthier. Mm-hmm. So there is an economic impact for cattle feeders out there.
Well, and you know, the comment back of, well, that's the packer's issue, is it always feeds back sooner or later. And, you know, every decision we make has a downstream effect. And up front, it may not cost us, but sooner or later, it's going to cost us in our profit. If it's a continual issue, they know where that's coming from, and they're going to discount you for that issue.
Yeah, we're in a system that, I mean, the beef industry is different than a lot of our other species. We're not as integrated, but the reality is we need to help each other and look out for each other and, you know, have the best interest for each other because we're working together.
I want to go back briefly, and this is probably out of my own selfishness, is back to the jerseys issues. And, you know, so I'm in Oregon and 75% of our dairy cows are jerseys.
Okay.
Because the cheese market.
Gotcha.
And so the jerseys are a massive issue, and it has been for a long time, is the Joe's Jersey bull calves just don't perform. They don't eat. They're actually fairly feed efficient, but they don't eat and they don't gain, and that makes them fairly feed efficient, but it takes them forever.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, and I know a lot of feedlots, they actually blood test, and if it's a Jersey crossed animal, they do not want it in the feedlot. And so, you know, that's a challenge for this beef on dairy, is that how can we make them more on the beef side than the Jersey side? And so going back to that study you're talking about for your master's, is how well did those beef on jerseys do versus your traditional jerseys, or what you're seeing with the beef on Holsteins?
The beef on Jersey, it did improve over the purebred Jersey. That was obvious. Now we raised those in a natural market. And like I said, one of the things I guess I would take away from that, looking back now, is that those cattle need all the help they can get still. So they need implants. We need to really focus for selecting those sires for ribeye area, for muscling. We need to focus on breeds that is their strength. Mm-hmm. I guess if you're in the, you want to use other technologies like beta agonists, those are only going to help.
Yeah.
So I guess that's my two cents on that. To my knowledge, nobody's done that. There was a study looking at implanting pure, it was just purebred jerseys, and they implanted, I think a Revlar 200, like every 60 days.
Yeah.
Very aggressive. There was obviously some safety concerns probably with that, just because of how aggressive those animals can get too from that. But yeah, they did see some improvements. I mean, technologies do work. I don't know that you have to be that aggressive. Obviously, you have to follow implant labels and stuff like that, which they've changed recently too. So that adds more challenges or fewer options for you regarding implants. But the use of implants on these dairy cattle is definitely helpful. So yeah, again, it comes down to sire selection. There has been a lot of, I know you see a lot of the Charolais Jersey crosses. That's been a really popular cross.
Yep.
Those seem to be turning out. I haven't worked with them personally, so I don't have a lot of great insight on them, but, I hear that they've been doing well. So, a lot of it comes down to produce the right calf so that you don't have something that's just really slow growing.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And I mean, depending what you're marketing into, I mean, and that was one of the intents of our study, was, is there the opportunity for selling these cattle into a niche market?
Right.
Which I think there definitely is. And we raise those cattle natural. I mean, that didn't help. I mean, if you're trying to produce a lot of product, but, or speed it up, but there are options out there because they do produce high quality beef. So yeah, it's a little bit, they're a smaller framed animal too. So it could be better designed for your direct fed beef to your customer, to consumers that are looking to buy a quarter or a half. Mm-hmm. I mean, cause just overall, I mean, there's a big difference when you're buying a steer that's 1100 pounds versus one that's 1400 or 1500 pounds.
Yep.
That total dollar value is a big difference for a customer looking to fill their freezer.
Yeah, a 900-pound carcass versus a 600-pound carcass is a big difference. And
yes,
a little off topic, but that's why at one point, and especially in like southern New Mexico, Arizona, a lot of these guys were actually raising criollos or corriente-type animals just for that market, as that produces a very small package for that direct fed or direct market opportunity. And it worked well for a lot of them. But
by selling direct, I mean, you can kind of choose your price too.
Correct.
You know? So there's opportunities there, I think, with Jersey cattle. You just have to be, you have to figure out how to make it work for you. Yep. The Jersey cattle have a tough time competing in the commercial market. I think that's fair to say. So you have to find other opportunities, and there are opportunities out there for people. You just have to explore what they are.
No, I think that's good. Good. Briefly talk about your MSU Feedlot Educational Series.
Being an extension, you get to do all sorts of things. Over here, I'm located in the thumb of Michigan on the eastern side, and we have a fair amount of dairy cattle over here. And as a result, quite a few feedlots have been set up to feed these Holstein bull calves in the past. So that's where I've been planted. And we have a pretty good group that likes to show up. We do a winter program series focusing on feedlot topics, cattle feeding topics. And so about once a month, we get together and come together at a restaurant. We have dinner and basically invite in a speaker. Someone gives a talk on a topic, and we're able to discuss it together, ask questions, and just able to catch up with each other. And that's been really good, really well received, I think. It's also another great opportunity to get information out. We have our last one here next week, Wednesday. And we're going to just kind of quickly review the National Beef Quality Audit results from this past year, kind of share what some of those findings are with our producers. So it's been a really successful program that's kind of, it was kind of started, I guess, maybe even before I started. It was just a group of cattle feeders that would get together, and now we've just kind of morphed it into, or just continued, I guess, but continue to present cattle feeding education through this, and it's been successful.
Good. Good. That's great to hear. I think, you know, I've got a strong heart for extension and helping producers. And it seems like with technology and funding of extension, it's harder and harder to actually put on those events that really have an impact. And so there's the big push of doing stuff from your office and you know, podcasts is, you know, where we're at today. But you know, you make a really big impact by that personal connection and that relationship with those producers, and you cannot do that from your office.
I would echo that 100%. I mean, I started during COVID, so all I was able to do, I had a tough time meeting people and whatnot. So being able to make those connections face to face, and for me to remember someone's name too, I mean, I have to meet you a few times. So this is a really great opportunity where we're able to network with each other, and people are able to ask each other about their operations, and it's been great. We've obviously developed some other programs, and you know, when the need arises, I mean, we've done some implant boot camps together, and luckily I have some great support from industry stakeholders, our industry groups and sales representatives that are always willing to help pitch in some funds to help put on those events too. So that's always great that we can continue to offer that education for our producers.
No, that's great. It's, you know, having those boots on the ground, and you have a continual access to needs assessment.
Yes. Yep.
That's great.
It's time for our famous three. We have a time and labor saving product for you. Beef and Dairy AgriSlat by Healthy Farms is your solution. No more lugging jugs around the barn every month. With Beef and Dairy AgriSlat, you simply drop the slat through the floor twice a year, and it works to break down solids, reduces crusting and forming. To learn more, visit myhealthyfarms.com.
So to wrap us up, I've got a few questions to ask you. And so the first one is, what is your go-to favorite resource for nutrition?
I would say the beef nutritional requirements book is, it's used heavily by me. If I ever need to look something up, double check something, that's where I go to see what kind of information is there. Otherwise, it's combing the the scientific journals for something that might not be in there or something that's new. So that's usually where I'm at when it comes to looking for information.
Yep. Same here. It's a great resource. And so lastly, in your opinion, what sets apart a successful beef professional? You know, if you see, you know, a guy that's really doing well in either in the industry or even in academia, what sets them apart?
I think a lot of it comes down to being personable and being able to network with each other. I mean, if you're likable enough and people want to work with you and talk with you and you're self-driven, that obviously helps. Being motivated to continue to learn and be on the cutting edge is always helpful. People look up to that. They want to know you. They want to know what you're doing. I think all those things are pretty desirable characteristics to being successful.
No, those are great. Those are great. Well, Jared, thanks for jumping on. I really enjoyed the talk. I learned a lot. And, you know, it's definitely a very hot topic for a lot of dairy producers, a lot of feedlot as well. It definitely is a big benefit for the beef industry. And I think a lot of guys don't understand that. Is that crossing these dairy cows with beef has really benefited the beef industry.
Yeah, and the dairy industry, I think they're making some pretty good money from it right now.
They are, especially when we look at the price of milk and the challenges a lot of dairies have. You know, that's a great opportunity to increase some revenue.
Yeah, it's a reminder to our dairy industry that, guess what? They're in the beef industry too.
They are.
From those calves, from those cull cows, etc. So yep. We all work together.
Well, thanks for taking the time. I'm sure a lot of people get a lot out of this. So thanks again.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.